There's some water right here on the table.
My name's Grace Day, and I'm an alcoholic. And she's right, a speaker I am not. I would like to thank Mill and the committee for inviting us to come to Mont Eagle. I have heard about it for many years through Mickey and Jim, and it's good to see Mickey. We've had a good day. We've seen parts of Tennessee that I never thought I'd see. We went that direction, we went that direction, we went back that direction, and then we went back that. We went to the chapel with Suwannee College, is that it? And we went to Falls Mills, we went to the bakery. We've just had a delightful day up to this point. I do get nervous. I really do. I have a friend in North Carolina who told me that if I ever stop getting nervous, it's time for me to sit down. So, I am a member of the Edgewood Group in Charleston, West Virginia. My sobriety date is August 9th, 1971. I like to think of myself as a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still go to meetings. I am sponsored, and I sponsor people. I go to lots of meetings. I go to roundups, and before I had my last drunk, I have not missed a state convention of West Virginia State Convention. So I didn't set out to make records. But I was told it was important that I support my area convention, and it was important that I support the Southeastern Convention, and I always try to go. Mercy, to get started. I was born and raised in Virginia, and I didn't set out to, I'd never thought I'd be an alcoholic. I wanted to be lots of things when I was growing up, but I grew up in a family that was very strict. My mother was Baptist. My father switched churches. He was a church jumper. And alcohol was always a sin. Drinking was always a sin. But card playing might not be a sin today, but tomorrow it would be, just depending on which church he went to. And I was very confused about God when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think my parents loved me. I know they loved me. They loved all of us. I had three brothers and two sisters, and I was the fifth child, and somebody said that was significant, because I learned to love fifths. Before I ever had a drink of alcohol, taking my inventory, going back, before I ever had a drink of alcohol, I was a liar. I was very dishonest. I was envious. I was ashamed of who I was. I wanted to be somebody else. I didn't want to be who I was. I wanted different parents. I lived in a fantasy world. I pretended to be somebody I wasn't. And I was just an alcoholic waiting to happen. I think that I had all the characteristics of an alcoholic, and I just was waiting for it to be activated by taking that first drink. My father said that he left me with an uncle when I was about 3 years old, and he came home, and the three of us, well, it's another guy, and my uncle and me, were passed out under a maple tree in the yard because they'd been feeding me beer. Well, I have no recollection of that, none at all. I was 3 years old, and it was a long time between drinks. I graduated from high school, went through school, and it was a dry county. There was no booze. There was nobody drank. If they drank, they sure were secret about it. Went to the regular high school functions. Nobody drank. I was never offered a drink. And I went to a business college and took a secretarial course and got, after I graduated, I got a job as a secretary. And it was on my first job that I met the man that I was to marry. And he was 14 years older than I was. He was an experienced drinker. And we dated for about 9 months, and we were married, and on my wedding day, champagne appeared at the reception, and I had my first drink. I wouldn't drink when we were dating because I didn't like the way it smelled. He would try, you know, he would kiss me goodnight, and I'd think, God, how can anybody drink that stuff? It's horrible. It stinks. And I wouldn't drink. Now, I may have tasted beer or something during the period that we dated, but on my wedding day, the champagne appeared, and he said, you will have to drink a toast. And I said, well, I can do that. And I didn't know. I thought it was because that I was happy. I was caught up in I was in love. I was happy, and I was getting married, and I was starting a new life with this man, and everything was going to be wonderful. And he was from a very, very wealthy family. Lots of money, more money than I'd ever been around. I mean, he didn't have it so much as his family had it, and we had access to it. I drank that champagne, and I know that I felt wonderful that day, and I thought it was because I was so happy. But you know, looking back on it, I think it was, you know, our book says we drink primarily for the effect. And I think it was the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't start out to make up for the years I hadn't drank. But I can tell you that drinking was a big, big part of our life. Drinking destroyed that marriage. It lasted for 11 years, and only by the grace of God did he not kill me or I kill him. It was a violent marriage. It was fights, and I'm not talking about verbal abuse. There were physical fist fights and throwing and shooting, and It was not a happy scene. It really wasn't in the end of the marriage. You know, I forget to say, when when I'm talking. I didn't always have this gray hair or all these wrinkles. I was young and I was a party girl, really. I liked to party. That marriage ended in divorce. In fact, we had the same lawyer. We really did. I got a cash settlement, blew it. It was gone. I moved to the D.C. area. First of all, I moved to the coast of Virginia and got a job and went to work. This marriage, I had always said that he was interfering. I mean, that I had to look after him, drive him home. I had to quit drinking at a certain point because I had to get us home. As I'm able to look back on it, or as I was able to look back on it in my inventory, it was because his drinking was interfering with my drinking. I wanted to get just downright with him and get drunk. And I had to look after him. That marriage, as I said, ended, and I moved to Virginia, to the East Coast of Virginia, and I thought, well, now I will really have fun. I'll go to parties, people will invite me to parties, he had already started having blackouts and was gone for 3 or 4 days at a time, and I didn't know where he was, and gosh, I was a candidate for Al-Anon way back there. But I was partying too. I didn't believe a word he said. Just did not believe that he was, didn't remember. I'd say, where you been? He'd say, I don't remember. Where'd you go? I don't remember. And who were you with? I don't know. You know, and I didn't believe that. I really did not believe that. But I moved to the coast, and I was going to have fun again. I was going to go to all these parties. I was going to, I was just going to have a good time. I was going to drink what I wanted to and do what I wanted to do, and I wouldn't have anybody watching over me. I had some money. But anyway, I went over and got a job, and no, I didn't get any invitations. Nobody invited me anywhere. And, you know, nobody knew me. How could they invite me anywhere? But anyway, I started drinking. I have been every type of drinker. I started drinking on the weekends. I had this job. I was working for 3 neurosurgeons in Norfolk, and I'd go home and the next day, the same old thing. And I was coming home one day, and there was a liquor store across the street, and I thought, I'm going to have me a drink. And I went in and bought a fifth, and I started drinking on weekends. And I would always stop and get me a six-pack of beer to sober up on Sunday so I could go back to work. I don't need to tell you that the day came I didn't go back to work. It might be Tuesday or Wednesday before it even come to. My brother lived in Norfolk, and he came and found me one day, and he called my father and told me to come and get me, told him to come and get me. My father came and got me, took me home to the D.C. area, and I had already started blacking out. I had already made a jail. I had already been in fights in bars. And I overlooked and ignored all the signs of alcoholism. My family did everything in their power to help me. But the one thing that they thought would help me is if they poured the liquor out, I wouldn't get drunk. And they were right. I wouldn't get drunk until I could find some more. But they bailed me out of jail. They loaned me money. They took me in. And I'm talking over a long period of time. They did everything they could to help me, but nobody, you know, nobody knew anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I'd never known an alcoholic except my husband, and he was a drunk, as far as I was concerned. My father came and got me, took me to the D.C. area, and for a while, that was just heaven. There was a bar on every corner. I drank in bars. I forgot that I was a lady. I wanted to be a lady. Every time I got drunk, in later years, I would think, I'm going to drink like a lady. Just pour, splash some bourbon over this ice, you know, and drink like a lady. And maybe the first couple of drinks, I would drink like a lady. And then I would chug-lug it out of the bottle, straight from the bottle, take the bottle to bed with me. I got involved with a lot of people in the D.C. area that drank just like I drank. I got connected with a guy that was a pilot. And this is probably the most exciting thing that ever happened to me when I was drinking. I met this guy, and we'd just take off. He, of course, didn't drink. And nobody, I don't think, drank like I drank. I say they did, but he couldn't fly a plane and drink, and he didn't. But I was usually loaded or well fortified. And we were coming back from Charlottesville, Virginia one day, and there was an airstrip, and there was activity. And he said, let's go down and see. And he did whatever he's supposed to do, and we went down to landed at this airstrip, and it was a skydiving club. And I thought that was real exciting. I really thought that was exciting. And I took some instructions. We went back several times. I don't know how many times we went back, but the day came when I was ready to take my first jump. And I jumped. I don't know how many times I jumped. I used to exaggerate it and say it was X number of times. I really, truly don't know how many times. I know that about the only thing that I knew to do is when I jumped out of that airplane was pull that ripcord. And the second thing that I can remember about all of it was the quiet. It was the quietest quiet I have ever known. And all of a sudden, you'd hear a ripple of the chute. And then I would be in a pond or a tree or hung up in a fence or scars on my face. And the most exciting thing, jump that I ever made, and was my last jump, was I landed in a tree and they couldn't get me out. And they had to call the, I don't know, I thought it was the fire department. It was the fire department. I'm pretty sure they didn't have rescue squads and all that stuff back in the 60s. And they came and he brought this bucket-like thing and, you know, raised it up. And the guy reached over to get me and he said, "You've been drinking." And I said, well, they climbed up to give me a beer, not knowing that if they could climb up to give me a beer, they could climb up and get me out of the tree. But That was my last job. And I went on. I moved on. I came to visit my sister one weekend, and I was already a regular jail, waking up in jail. I was having blackouts. I may be in Charlottesville one day, and I'd be in Richmond the next. And I'd have no idea how I got there. I didn't know who took me there. I could never find a car, but I would always come to enough to know that I was with somebody and they would get me back. And, if somebody said, let's go so-and-so, I'd go. I just thought it was a good idea. I was frequenting the jails. I was having blackouts. I could not keep a job. I had become a parasite on society and everybody else. I used people, abused people. Thank God I had no children in this marriage. And I was, I thought footloose and fancy free, and I was killing myself, and I really did not know it. I came to visit my sister, and I was watching TV, and there was an Army recruiter, and she was telling about how exciting the Women's Army Corps was, and the travel and the romantic places you could go to, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic, and that sounds wonderful to me. And she went off and she said, can you qualify? And I went the next day and qualified. I joined the Women's Army Corps, and I was an alcoholic, and I could not take care of myself. And I was looking for somebody to take me in, take care of me, and they did. The next day I was in Fort McClellan, Alabama, in basic training, and I'm in my late 20s. My sister put me on a plane and she said, you have totally lost your mind. And she said, you'll never make it through basic training. And all of you know that's the wrong thing to say to an alcoholic. I made it through basic training at the top of my class. We were not allowed to drink. We didn't get any leaves or anything like that when I was in basic training. And I was trained to be a court reporter. And went to Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis. And I was trained to be a court reporter. I worked in court martials. I knew what would happen to me if I got in too much trouble. I planned my drinking. So this was the period of controlled drinking for me. I was pretty well straightened out in 8 weeks of basic training, not drinking, so I was in pretty good shape. But I wouldn't drink unless I could have all I wanted. I would, so that was my controlled drinking period. I made it through basic training and I made it through to an honorable discharge. I don't know how, but I just didn't drink as much. I got out of the Army. And I'm nearing the end of my drinking. I got out of the Army and I started drinking, took what money I had, and I drank, I got out the end of September, and I came to in November. The longest blackout I had ever had. And it proved to me that alcoholism is progressive. I came to in November, and I was in Toms River, New Jersey, in a trailer. I don't know who it belonged to. I don't know who I was there with. My car was outside. It would not start. I had to go get some people. Well, first of all, I went to a little grocery-like store to get a newspaper to see what day it was. And that was a habit of mine, that I had to get newspapers to see what day it was. I remembered I had one person that loaned me some money in Fort Dix. And I was, as I said, I was in Toms River. And all of a sudden, something dawned on me that this girl I was stationed with in Indianapolis lived in Denver, and she said, if you ever are in trouble, said, I think she knew I had a serious problem. If you're ever in trouble, come to Denver. And so I'm heading to Denver. I'm going to go to Denver. And not knowing if the girl lived in Denver, didn't have a phone number, didn't have anything, you know, but I'm going to Denver. But the strange thing is I headed south instead of west from Fort Dix. And I stopped in Fairfax, Virginia, and my father told me, he took one look at me and he knew I had been on one good drunk. And he said, you can stay the night, but when morning comes, you're going to move on. And it was November, hadn't had antifreeze or anything in my car. He got my car and checked my car over for me, and so I went on, but I went further south. I had a brother that lived in Blacksburg, Virginia. I stopped there, and the curtains moved. When I knocked on the door, I could see somebody behind the curtains, but nobody came to the door. And then I went to my sister's that lived in Bluefield, West Virginia. And for the first time in my life, somebody confronted me about my alcoholism and told me the truth. She said, I don't want you around my daughter. You're not welcome to stay here. You can stay the night. But in the morning, when I leave, I want your car to be in front of mine going out the driveway. She said, I would rather you would be dead. At least I would know where you are. And I had told the mall, see, that I was coming home after I was discharged the end of September. But October passed, and they hadn't heard from me. So the next morning, I left, and I hated that family as much as I'd ever hated anybody. What right did they have to put me out? My sister gave me a little bit of money and wished me well. I left, and I had one more stop to make, and that was a sister in Charleston, West Virginia, and that's what got me to Charleston. I had very little money left, and my sister was married to an active alcoholic or a hard drinker. And she thought, because I had been in the Army, that I was cured. And had gotten an honorable discharge and all this stuff. So she asked me to stay. And she said if I would stay, maybe she would have the courage, she'd have somebody to support her to get out of this alcoholic marriage that she was in. And that eventually happened. And I don't know what happened. That was in November of 67. I stayed pretty much dry for the whole month of a whole year of 68 until along about September of 68. I know what I used as an excuse, and we don't need an excuse. I wanted to drink, and I drank. And in just that little bit of time that I had stayed in pretty good, I had gotten in good graces with my family again. They were welcoming me. I was could go back and visit. My sister in Charleston had started divorce proceedings, and I had a good job, and everything was going good, and I started to drink. September, October, November, December, and January, I would get sober, and I would get drunk, I would get sober, I'd get drunk, and it was just, I worked for the state of West Virginia, and they didn't question you too much as long as you had sick leave to cover it and could get a doctor's excuse, and I had met a doctor that would write you an excuse for anything, so I protected my job, and after a particularly bad experience, bad drunk, I came to in, I had started drinking in Bluefield, West Virginia, and I came to in Charleston in my bed. And first thing I did was look for the bottle, and of course it was in the bed with me. And I jumped up and called the office. Well, I got the newspaper, jumped up, called the office, told them I wouldn't be in, and then went to the liquor store and bought another fifth. And I think I was just going to drink myself to death, and it just didn't work that way. I came to, and I knew that I had to drink. I knew I was going to die if I didn't drink. And I thought I would die if I didn't. I was in a mess. And I started calling for help. This was in January of 69. And my sister in Charleston hung up on me. She heard my voice, she hung up. And my sister in Bluefield said, let me get back to you. And she called me back a little bit later, and she said, I forgot to tell you, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous in D.C. And I don't know how many meetings I went to, and I remember the last meeting that I was at I was in Manassas, Virginia. They had an Eaton meeting. The speaker was a woman, and she talked about coming to out of a black, dancing nude on a table. She came to out of blackout, and she was dancing nude on a table. And I thought, well, that hasn't happened to me. I don't do that. And that's the night I left Alcoholics Anonymous in D.C. I left the only people that could help me at that time. And just continued. But anyway, I called my sister, and she said, let me get back to you. And she called back a little bit. Now, the snow is flying. We already have 3 or 4 inches of snow. It's cold. The wind's blowing. The roads are slick. And I wanted her to come to Charleston and lock me up. I said, I'm going to have to be locked up. I cannot. I absolutely cannot stop drinking. And she said, let me call you back. She called me back a little bit later and she said, Grace, I've called Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you tried them once and I think you ought to try them again. And she said, they won't come though. They won't talk to you unless you ask for help. Tell them just exactly what you told me, that you need help, that you cannot stop drinking. And she said, they'll talk to you. And a little bit later, a woman from Alcoholics Anonymous called me. And this was one of the kindest, sweetest women I have ever known. And she got a man, and they came out on those slick roads. And I lived on a hill, and they came and made a genuine, honest-to-God 12-step call on me. And they sat with me, and they talked with me, and they brought me literature. And I don't want to ever, ever forget that. They asked me if I could stop drinking just for a day. And I said, I don't know. I really did not know if I could stop drinking for a day. And they said, well, we'll come by tomorrow evening, pick you up and take you to a meeting, and somebody will call you in the morning. And they left about, I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I walked the floor, and I wrung my car keys in my hand, and I thought, I've got to go get a drink. I'll have to go get a drink. And that's how I spent my first day of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Walking the floor, ringing my car keys, saying I'll wait 5 minutes more, 10 minutes more. I'll wait until after she calls me. After she calls me, then I'll go to the liquor store. And miracle of miracles, I didn't go to the liquor store. I went to a meeting and they picked me up. And let me tell you, I couldn't clean myself up. I couldn't get a comb to my hair. They came in and they dressed me. They helped me get ready. They dressed me. They brushed my hair. And they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even count those meetings I went to in D.C. I told you my sobriety date when I started. You know that something happened. I started going to meetings, and we didn't have a meeting every day, but I went to as many meetings as we had and as many as I could get to. And I got drunk in April, a couple months, and then I stayed dry until July of 71. And if you want to know how not to stay sober, I can tell you. I can sure tell you. I did everything opposite from what you told me. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't want a sponsor because you wouldn't let me get a man. Or the women wouldn't. I didn't identify with those old broads. And it's funny, I say today I sat around and became an old broad. I didn't identify with them. I didn't understand them. I didn't understand drinking in the kitchen, behind the curtains. I understood you guys getting out there and belting it down in a bar and getting in brawls and getting in fights, and I loved it. And that's what I wanted, was a man sponsor. And so I didn't have a sponsor, didn't have a home group. Didn't have a home group, didn't have a sponsor, didn't have, just didn't do anything that I was supposed to do. And When an untreated alcoholic is backed into a corner, they will either drink or they will take some action to change things. Well, I drank. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I did the only thing that I knew to do that would help me. I drank. I picked up a drink. I went to the liquor store. I bought 5 fifths. A bottle of cold duck wine, because they told me how good it was. I had heard in AA how good it was. And I bought a six-pack of beer. I was not a beer drinker. I loved bourbon better than anything. And I started my last drunk on cold duck wine. And I'm here to tell you all, it is not worth it. It is not worth it. I don't know when the drunk started. I got a resentment at an AA member, and that's what started it. I couldn't deal with it, and so I drank. And I don't know how long the drunk lasted. I know that I came to in a drying out hospital. I had never been hospitalized, never been treatment. But I was in a detox hospital, and I got out of that hospital on a Thursday morning. And the first thing, I surrendered. I knew that I had to follow directions or I was going to die. And I remember that last night when they gave me my last drink, I just said, God help me. I prayed or said, God help me, to a God I didn't believe in. Of all these churches that I had been drugged to as a child. And I came to, during that time that I had been dry in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went and took instructions and became Catholic. Didn't believe in the Baptist God, Catholic God, Presbyterian God, Episcopal God. Didn't believe in any God. But I went through the motions, and I did say, God help me. And I got out of that hospital, and I went to the Edgewood group on Thursday night, and I asked them if I could join, and they told me I could. There was a man there that I knew his wife real well, and I asked him if he would sponsor me, and he said he would until I could find a lady sponsor. He said, and I told him, I said, I'm going to call Jody. I called his wife and told her, you know, that I had asked God to sponsor me. And when I called him, that's why I'd be calling. And then I met this lovely lady that became my sponsor and was my sponsor for 18 years. And I loved her dearly. She walked me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to recover. She never lied to me. The only time I disagreed with her is we had a pretty heated argument about God one day, and I felt like she was forcing religion on me. But we ironed that out, and she told me the truth. She told me what I needed to do and what I had to do if I expected to stay sober. I couldn't just go to AA meetings. I couldn't just go to roundups and conventions and things that I loved. I have always been in love with things like Mont Eagle. We have some at home. Bluestone Mickey's been there, and Bluestone and Cedar Lakes and Jackson's Mills, and some of you have spoken there, and I've always just loved them. I got active in service, And I mean, we're talking over a period of time. This all didn't happen overnight. Everything wasn't good, kind, and wonderful right away for me. It was a period of reconstruction and altering my life and bringing a change about in my life. And the first 2.5 years when I was in AA, I was looking for a man. I wanted a man. I wanted somebody to share my life with, and my of course didn't have a sponsor to talk to, so you know. But the sponsor that I got told me, she said, "You are not allowed to date for 2 years." And she said, "If you want to date somebody, you go out and mess with somebody that's not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't go sit and don't go get mixed up with somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous that you have to sit across the table from when you're mad at them." And of course, they've changed that now. I think that the time requirement is about 6 months. But my sponsor knew what I needed. She knew that I didn't know me. How could I have a relationship with somebody if I didn't know me? And she said, "I just don't want you messing somebody else's life up." And when I was sober 8 years, Al and I started a relationship, and that was the 8 years. I met him in 72, and it just happened, and it's been wonderful. I got active in service, and now. In the general service structure, I was a GSR, I was secretary of the area committee, I was a DCM, I was area chairman, and I was elected delegate to the General Service Conference to represent West Virginia. I wish that everybody could do that. I know it's impossible. It was an experience that I will treasure the rest of my days. By working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous daily, I think for me the most important step is a 10th step. If I don't let things ball up and let the garbage pile up, if I take care of it on a daily basis, then I don't have all this turmoil going on in my life. There's no way I can tell you how I came to believe in a power greater than me. I don't know. I can't explain it to you. I know that I would imagine that it was in the seeking that I finally found God. I'm comfortable today with the God of my understanding, with the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, not the God of the churches. We went to that beautiful chapel today, and I felt comfortable being there. But the God of my understanding was with me, not the Episcopal God. And you know, it's hard for me to get up here and tell you all, in a few months, if I live, God willing, I'll have 30 years of sobriety. And I didn't start out to do that. I really didn't. But I cannot tell you how remarkable this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is and what it's done for me, and how it's changed my life. I've had the most wonderful relationship with my family since I got sober. I had a wonderful experience with an employer that I was able to retire from with a good pension, enough to make me comfortable and keep me comfortable. And the things that Al and I have been able to travel, we went to meetings in Ireland and in Scotland, and we go places. Like, we're going to Louisville next weekend because we picked up a flyer and we liked the speaker lineup, and we said, let's register, so we're going. And there's just no way I can explain how Alcoholics Anonymous has affected my life. I know that if I stick close to this big book, if I do what this big book tells me to do, and if I follow its direction, that I'll be relatively happy and serene most of the time. I heard a lady speak on a tape, and I've never met her. I don't even know if she's still sober. But we listened to lots of tapes, and I heard her describe what she felt like Alcoholics Anonymous was, I understood it. I understood what she was talking about. She said, it's like in a diamond mine in Africa. And this miner sees a glint in a glob of mud or a rock, and he picks it up and he says, I think I found something. And he takes it to his boss and he washes it and he says, yes, I think you found something. And they send it to a gemologist and they cut it and they polish it and they chip it and they shine it and polish it and grind it. And what emerges is a beautiful, beautiful, flawless diamond. And I would like to think, she said, I would like to think that when I meet my maker, that I am going to be a flawless diamond. And I came here as a blob of nothing, just a total nothing. I was worthless, I was helpless, and I was hopeless. And you all put my life back together. And I am eternally grateful to you. Thank you for letting us come, and I'm looking forward now to the rest of the weekend. Thank you.